ॐ सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ वेरि गुड् Welcome to you all. Welcome also to the many students attending this class online. We continue with chapter 23 of Uddhava Gita. We're actually coming towards the end of the chapter, which explains why the topics have been so profound, and you may find them a little heavy. This is a very profound unfoldment of the main central teachings of Advaita Vedanta. So not surprising if you find his teachings a little bit heavy. The topic where Sri Krishna has been building up to is the non-duality of your true self. Your true self, Atma, consciousness. Here's the ironic way to look at it. The consciousness that's present right now in your experience is not your consciousness. It is the one consciousness illumining the mind of every sentient being. And the body sitting in your chair is not your body. In fact, it is a manifestation of the fundamental reality because of which everything exists. And turns out that your consciousness, what you call your consciousness, that is in fact the one consciousness, and the fundamental reality because of which your body exists, those are one and the same thing. That's it. That is the ultimate teaching of Advaita Vedanta. And if it seems rather lofty, of course, this is the ultimate teaching of Vedanta. What's interesting is how something present in our experience can be so terribly misunderstood. Consciousness is present in your experience, but you don't get it. That it's not your consciousness. Your body is present in your experience, but you don't get it, that your body is a tiny part of Ishvara, so to speak. You know, this is the limitation of experience. In modern times, we've come to put so much trust, so much faith in experience, and as we've discussed many times, that faith is not well deserved. You know, I give the sunset example again and again. You've never seen the sun go down. It doesn't go down. The earth turns. And that example shows how faulty experience is as a guide to reality. Here's our metaphor for today. First mistake is, suppose I have 100 pots, and you count them, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 99, 100, I have 100 pots. No, I don't. I have one clay. And then you observe another thing. By the way, so that's referring to Brahman as the fundamental substratum because of which your body exists. But here's the other perspective. This pot is full of pot space. Each of these 100 pots have their own individual pot spaces. How many spaces are there? There is but one all-pervasive spot space. It's just a small metaphor to suggest how just because this pot is in your experience doesn't mean you understand it properly. Ignorance. And just because your body and consciousness are present in your experience right now doesn't mean they're understood properly. properly, which is why Sri Krishna is giving this elaborate teaching to Uddhava and therefore to all of us. So with this introduction, we will pick up the thread. Etavanatma sammoho, etavanatma sammoho, yadvikalpastu kevale, yadvikalpastu kevale, atmanrite swamatmanam, atmanrite swamatmanam, avalambo natasya hi, avalambo natasya hi yasya. Good. In the second line, yad vikalpahatu kevale, kevale, on the one. Kevala means only, and it's used here to refer to that one conscious reality, the reality that we're calling Atma. Sri Krishna calls Atma here. So kevale, on that one non-dual Atma, yadvikalpaha, we make all these projections. One clay, many pots. One Brahman, many bodies. One all-pervasive consciousness, many individual experiences. We see many, but all of these manys are manifest. Manys? Is that a word? All of these manys are manifestations of an underlying reality, the reality we call Atma. So, yadvikalpaha too, but all the duality that we experience, etavan atma sammohaha, etavan, all of it, all of this, is atma sammoha, due to sammoha, fancy word for ignorance. Ignorance about what? Atma. If you don't know clay, you only see pot. If you don't know Brahman, you only see lots of bodies. If you don't know consciousness as such, you find there are many experiences. So ignorance leads to the perception of duality. Tell me, though, when this ignorance goes away, this is an important point that a lot of people miss. When duality goes away, when you're enlightened, do you cease perceiving duality? Wouldn't that be odd? You only see undifferentiated gray fog. Huh? That's my representation of non-duality. Look at this. When you understand that I'm holding 100 pots, suppose. When you understand all these 100 pots are nothing but clay, do you cease perceiving 100 pots? No. You just understand the underlying reality because of which the duality is apparent. Or if you consider the space inside these 100 pots, when you understand there's only one space, do you still... Can I fill this pot with something? You say, yes, of course. So we still experience pot space. So the point is that when the ignorance that causes us to experience duality is removed, it's the ignorance that gets removed, not the experience of duality. And that's a really good thing. How could we function if everything were a undifferentiated, fuzzy, gray cloud? So you get the point. Last, second half here. Atman rite, rite. In the absence of Atman, the true self, which is swam atmanam, which is the essence of you. Notice this isn't talking about something called Atma. This turns out to be a pet peeve for me. If I pick up a book and it's in English and it says the Atma. Atma is, you know, the chair, the table, the leg, the Swami, the Atma. The moment you put that article "the" in front of Atma, you reduce it to an ordinary thing in the universe. Atma is not that. Atma is fundamental reality. So, Sri Krishna says here, Atman rite, in the except for that Atma, Atma which we understand as Brahman, and which Sri Krishna has another name for it. I'm smiling. Can you guess where I'm going with this? What is Sri Krishna's name for Atma? Is it me? He constantly says that in both the Bhagavad Gita and the Uddhava Gita. Sri Krishna identifies himself as that Atma. So Atman Rite, except for this Atma, which is Swatmanam, which is the reality because of which you exist, he says, yasya, for this duality, the duality that we perceive, the duality that we experience, he says, nahi avalambaha. There is no avalamba, literally that which you hang upon, but in this case, substratum, underlying reality. Other than Atma, there is no fundamental reality because of which everything exists. Again, to put aside any possibility of duality. There's no duality within Atma, and this last part says there's no other Atma to create duality. No, this is just something to show the profundity of these teachings of Advaita Vedanta. To be non-dual, there's three kinds of non-duality, three kinds of absence of duality are described by these great scholars. One is to be non-dual, there shouldn't be a second thing. There shouldn't be Atma A and Atma B, or Atma A and Brahman B. One fundamental. So there's no duality in that sense. Further, there's no Atma and stuff. That's a second kind of duality. Atma versus Atma, Atma 1, Atma 2 is one kind of duality. Atma and Unatma is a second kind of duality. This is not a topic. I'm just very briefly giving you some insight into how profound and complete these teachings are. So one kind of duality is between A and B. I'm sorry, A1 and A2. Sorry to be a little bit fussy. So there's a difference between, if there is A1 and A2, we have duality. If there's an A and a B, we have duality. And there's a third kind of duality. Where would that be? If A is internally got parts, if A is made of parts, that is a kind of duality. So in the commentaries where they get into all these details, they always speak of non-duality in terms of all three of these criteria. Let's continue. Yannama kriti bhir grahyam, yannama kriti bhir grahyam, panchavarnama badhitam, panchavarnama badhitam, vyartenha pyartavadoyam, artenha pyartavadoyam, dvayam pandita maninam, Pandita Mani has two meanings. One, the obvious one is someone who considers himself to be a pandit is a pandita manin, is a self-appointed expert. How many of them are there in the world? And I don't watch TV, but I remember if you turn on your television set on a Sunday morning, you get to watch all the political pundits, and they all have the answer. Of course, if they all have the answer, why are they all saying different things? It's a little confusing, but anyway, these are self-appointed pundits, or more exactly, they're appointed by the television networks. The TV network says there are two criteria. You have to know a lot about politics, and there's a more important criteria for TV. You have to look really good. So if you have both those criteria, you can be a political pundit on Sunday morning talk shows. So here, these pundits, though, have nothing to do with politics. We're talking about our spiritual realities. So they are pandita manan. They consider themselves to be experts about spirituality. They're also experts about dvayam, duality. They understand duality. So these are not the Advaita Vedantins. In fact, someone who really is, oh gosh, I can get myself into trouble here, because there are many people who study a lot of Advaita Vedanta, and they consider themselves pundits, they consider themselves learned in Advaita Vedanta, experts, knowledgeable about Advaita Vedanta, but they are still as mean and ornery as ever, which means that they have studied all this Advaita Vedanta without being changed at all, without undergoing any process of an internal growth at all, which means, this is the word for them, Pandita Mana. They consider themselves wise, but the wise consider them otherwise. Got it. Okay. And they know everything about duality. For example, now jump up to the first line. They understand what about duality? Yat nama akriti, nama name. Akriti is a synonym for form. So you've heard name and form many times, the same expression. Nama akriti, nama rupa. Nama rupa, nama, nama akriti bihi grahyam. The world that we experience is grahyam, it is grasped. It is experienced as nama rupa with all of these many names and forms. So these great pundits, again, imagine holding 100 pots. These great pundits can't imagine that I'm holding on to one clay. They can't conceive of it because they experience duality. They're stuck at that level of thinking. Further, these pseudo-pandits are panchavarnam abaditam. They consider panchavarnam. Varna here means group. Panchavarna, the five elements, everything made of five elements. They consider these five elements, which means the physical world in which we live, they consider these five elements to be abaditam, non-negatable. So non-negatable. In fact, in just to make an interesting metaphor, I like scientific metaphors. So in science, atoms were considered abaditam, non-negatable. In fact, the word atom comes from Greek, not, toma, tomas, tomography. Tomography is breaking up your kidney stones. Anyway, breaking. Tomos. Tomos, that which is not breakable. That's an ancient Greek concept about atoms, which persisted until 120 years ago, 100 years ago. Only then scientists said, hey, wait a minute, we can break those things. And of course, modern science evolved a lot from that. So the point is that even modern scientists have figured out that this world is not as real and solid and objective as it seems. Now, if you say, well, Swamiji, they didn't have the benefit of all this modern science in ancient times, absolutely true. But it's also true that in ancient times, the truly wise, not our pseudo-pundits, but the truly wise knew that before these atoms existed, they were non-existent. Which is to say, this universe had a beginning. These pseudo-pundits can't imagine that this universe had a beginning. You know, to make a pod is one thing, but to make a universe? These pseudo-pundits couldn't wrap their minds around it, so to speak. And these pseudo-pundits were also apparently very focused on rituals, not surprisingly. And so the last point Sri Krishna makes here is vyartena api artavaraha ayam, that these pseudo-pundits consider ayam, these teachings about non-duality, they consider them to be artavada. Artavada is actually a technical term used in analysis of the Vedas, and it's an analysis of the Vedas done by the school of rituals, we'll call it, those who were committed to ritualistic practices alone. Now, the technical term, those of you who love Sanskrit terminology, mimamsaka. The karma mimamsakas were committed to interpreting the Vedas purely as guidance for how to do all these rituals. So tell me, if you were an ancient karma mimamsaka and you turn to the Veda, that's the end part of the Veda where it says, I am Atma Brahma, this Atma, this consciousness, which is manifest in your body and mind, it is Brahman, it is identical to the underlying reality because of which the cosmos exists. Now here's the problem. If you are an ancient mimamsaka and you read that in the Veda, you have to make sense of it in terms of rituals. So how do the karma mimamsakas teach, how do they interpret these very Advaitic statements that are found in the Upanishads? Well, they made up their own explanation. You know how it goes when you have an agenda, you make up an explanation to suit the agenda. Everyone does this, especially politicians, but everyone. So when you have an agenda, you put a spin on everything to support your position. So the mimamsakas put a spin on the Mahavakyas and all these profound teachings, and they call them artavada. These are statements of praise. That's what artavada means in this context. Artavada, they're all meant to praise the Ishvara, who is the recipient of all of our worship, of all of our sacrifices into the sacrificial fire. So these mimamsakas are also in this category of pseudo-scholars. Why? Because they study the whole Veda. In fact, they study the Veda a lot more than any Advaita Vedantin will study the Veda, because they understand all the rituals. I don't understand all the rituals. I don't care to understand all the rituals, but for them, the rituals are most important, and therefore, based on their interpretation, they basically ignore these profound spiritual teachings found in the Upanishad. And Sri Krishna says, Vyartena, they do so in a way that reduces the Vedas to meaninglessness. They miss what Vyarta means, useless. They convert the Upanishads into useless statements. They convert the wisdom of the ancient rishis into mere praise. Sri Krishna says, Vyarta, useless. So, now, okay, this is, by the way, our first topic of non-duality comes to an end here. But before we leave it, we need to tie it up a little bit before we move on. Put it like this. Most people in the world take everything at face value. The world is what it seems to be. And that's, if you think about it, even this tiny little bit, you understand that they're missing something tremendous. What you see is what you get. These same people, when they look at a screen on their phone or computer and see people there, do they take them as people? They experience people on those screens, but they know that the people on those screens are not real people. They are projections. They are images. And here's my complaint. If they're smart enough to know that the image on the screen is not as real as it seems, then why aren't they able to understand that the world of duality is not as real as it seems? Maybe 1,000 years ago we had an excuse. We didn't have 100 years ago we didn't have all these screens. But now we take it for granted. We live in a world of illusion, in a matter of sense, that, you know, how much time do you spend during the day looking at a screen? Do you take any of that as being independently existent? Or do you understand that every bit of it is projected on your screen? You understand thoroughly. Then why do most people have such a hard time understanding that just as what's on the screen isn't as real as it seems, what we experience in the world is not as real as it seems? This, to me, it seems like a huge blunder, a huge oversight in thinking, and that is the thinking of the Panditamana, the ones who think that they think they know. They think this world is what it is, and it's simply not true. Okay, now we're coming very near the end of this chapter. I think we'll finish it in the next class. And towards the end, at the end here, Sri Krishna returns to a topic I think we all enjoyed very much, and that was when he was talking about the Ku-yogi. So Ku-yogi means a yogi who's not very skillful, a yogi. And remember the context. We talk about a yogi who was engaged in spiritual practice in particular. A yogi engaged in the practice of meditation, why? It feels good. They were attached to the bliss of meditation. Dhyana ananda. Dhyana sukha is actually the term that's used in texts. Dhyana sukha means the sukha, the pleasure you get out of meditation. And when you become a skilled metaphor, it's really, it's nice. You know, it takes some time to get there. But when you get there, you can, it's just nice. It certainly is a lot nicer than finishing your meditation and going and dealing with all the nonsense in your day-to-day life. You meditate. When you meditate, your boss is gone. Your family is gone, which may not be such a good thing. Your bills are gone. All the headaches of your life, they just go away when you meditate. So not surprising that these yogis seek dhyana sukha. They seek that pleasant experience in meditation. And by doing so, they've made a huge blunder. And we'll come back to that blunder in just a few minutes. But a word of support of these yogis. When I traveled in India, most yogis fall into that category. And to put things in context, these yogis are engaged in practices which don't lead to moksha. They're engaged in more worldly kinds of practices, including smoking marijuana, etc. They're engaged in these practices. Why? In my opinion, because they didn't have good teachers. If you have a good guru, those who have had Pujya Swami Dayananda as their guru, they're in great shape. You won't find any of my guru bhais meditating for the sake of happiness, nor will you find them smoking marijuana, so far as I know. I think it's a good assumption, though. So, having lived in Rishikesh for a while, I really have come to I came long ago to understand that so many sincere sadhakas, spiritual aspirants, are engaged in all kinds of unhelpful spiritual practices because they have been misdirected. Not maliciously misdirected. So their teacher thought they knew what was going on. Here again, pseudo-pandit. Here's our pandita mana. Their teachers thought that they knew what was going on. They weren't enlightened. They had studied a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and they became gurus. And once you become guru, then disciples come. And whatever kind of nonsense that they had discovered through studying a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little bit of that, then whatever they picked up along the way, they give that as authoritative guidance to these innocent young sadhus. And that's sad. I find that particularly sad because they're sincere. Think, this is a little bit of an aside, but nice to bring it out right here. Think about a sincere young man or young woman today who, say, suppose they finish high school, they finish college, and they're not inclined to plunge into a profession. They're not inclined to get married just yet, and they want to explore spiritual life. After all, they've read the Bhagavad Gita, and they've gone to some lectures, and they understand the profundity of this spiritual tradition. So they think that, well, before I get engaged in worldly life, in a career and getting married and all that, let me go to Rishikesh and spend a year studying in Rishikesh and see what that spiritual life is about. I really feel sorry for the young people who may do that. And you know very well there, not just from India, from this country, from around the world. You know, they go to Rishikesh or some other place, and sadly, the vast majority of what they find there is well-intended, but not authentic. And that's a shame. Not authentic in the sense that what they will hear and the practices they will receive are not going to lead them to much spiritual growth. It may help them some. Without doubt, many of those practices will help them some, but there are so many shortcomings about shortcomings with regard to those teachings which are popular today, not just in Rishikesh, but everywhere. And I just really feel bad that these young people get misled in that way. And maybe I end up making a point out of this because I could have been one of those young people. Because in 1970s, when I started my spiritual quest, what did I know? I was just as naive, I was more naive than all of these youngsters. I was much more naive. And I went to this spiritual group, and you know, I did for a while. Then I'd go to this. What would happen to me is I would go to a spiritual group until I heard things I didn't agree with, as if I knew anything. But when something was said that didn't sit well with me, then I left. So I tried this spiritual group, and then I left. Tried this spiritual group, then I left. Tried this spiritual group, then I left. Suppose I found a spiritual group and didn't hear anything particularly obnoxious and stuck it out. Then I was naive enough that the spiritual group I might have stayed with could have been an unhelpful spiritual group. I consider myself so fortunate that I say this intentionally, I stumbled upon Pujya Swami Dayananda. I just happened to attend a lecture series he taught, and naturally that transformed everything for me. So maybe this is the reason why I feel so bad for these enthusiastic young people setting off on their spiritual journeys, because I could have been one of them. I could have gotten in so much trouble. Our context here is Sri Krishna is going to return to our topic about those yogis who did not find the right teacher and were misled, misdirected. And again, not maliciously misdirected, because the guru thought he or she knew what they were doing. Anyway, that's what happens. So with that, we'll come back to our and this, I think, this is the final topic in the chapter, talking about these yogis, both the yogis on the right path, but first the yogis on the other path. He says, yogino pakva yogasya, yogino pakva yogasya, yunjata kaya uttitaihi, yunjata kaya huttitaihi, upasargar vihanyeta, upasargar vihanyeta, tatrayam vihito vidhi, tatrayam vihito. Yoginaha, those yogis, plural, yoginaha, yoginaha, for a yogi who is apakva yogasya, one for whom yoga, their spiritual practice, yoga has so many meanings, so here, spiritual practice, their yoga is apakva. You can figure out what that means, most of you. Means you know, the nice American expression, half-baked. So, which literally it means in context, it means incomplete. So their spiritual practice is incomplete. They are half-baked yogis. And yunjataha, while they're engaged in their practice, what happens to their kayaha, their bodies? And for their bodies, next sign, upasargaihi, by dutu upasargas, problems, pains, and problems uttitaihi that arise. So different problems arise in the body. So you can imagine a yogi sitting in Padmasana for hours. If you sat in Padmasana for hours, could you even stand up? Assuming that you could get in Padmasana in the first place. If you could, after sitting like that for several hours, I guarantee you, you won't be able to stand until the muscles kind of regain their normal state. So think of these yogis who sit in Padmasana for hours, or something we tend to forget. These yogis don't have, in modern and ancient times, no jobs, right? No jobs means no money. No money means, where do you live? So they didn't have luxurious residences. They didn't have big homes. They didn't have comfortable beds, big homes with central heating and comfortable beds and all these amenities. They didn't have toilets. You know, they lived tough lives. And living those tough lives, they were absolutely subject to varieties of physical afflictions, and Sri Krishna said, vihanyeta, what they had to do to remove their physical afflictions, tatra ayam vihitaha vidihi. Sri Krishna says, tatra, with regard to handling the many afflictions they experience while practicing yoga without money, without a comfortable lifestyle, without even necessarily a healthy lifestyle, to handle those problems, I am vihitaha vidihi. This is the method they followed. Sri Krishna is going to describe the methods they used to handle the illnesses and discomforts they had to deal with, and he describes in some detail in the next verse. Yoga dharana ya kanchata, yoga dharana ya kanchata, asanar dharanan vitaihi, asanar dharanan vitaihi, tapo mantraushadai kanchat, tapo mantraushadai kanchat, upasargan vinirdahet. Upasargan vinirdahet. Okay, what should the yogis do to remove all these afflictions? Sri Krishna says, yoga dharanaya kanschit. Kanschit, some of their difficulties, some of their discomfort and illness was removed. How? Yoga dharanaya, through the very practice of meditation. And you think, how does the practice of meditation get rid of discomfort? I'm smiling because the commentator made a hilarious observation. Suppose the yogi is in this cold, damp cave. What should that yogi meditate on? Meditate on the sun. So according to the commentator, by meditating on the sun, that yogi sitting in a cold, damp cave can overcome shivering. And suppose instead they're sitting under a tree outside on a beautiful April day. I'm being sarcastic. A beautiful April day is 120 degrees. And they're in. So what should that yogi meditate on? Should meditate on the moon, according to the commentator. The moon is considered one whose rays are cooling. We know that's not exactly true, but that was the ancient concept. The rays of the sun are burning. The rays of the moon are cooling. Anyway, here the point is that through various meditation practices, you can get over some physical discomforts? What about physical discomforts that you can't meditate away? By the way, if your legs are paining, you meditate deeply enough. What legs? Seriously, it's not a big deal. If you're an experienced meditator, experienced yogi, you can easily get your mind away from that pain. What about other things? What about actually physical illnesses? So you can't meditate away the flu or bad cold or something. So then what? It says, for other kinds of problems, asanaihi dharananvitaihi. So for other illnesses, you should practice dharana, meditation. Meditation, which is anvitaihi, meditation practices, which are accompanied by asanaihi, the practice of asana. So don't just sit there, do something. Get up, perform some yogasanas. These yogasanas were done vigorously to keep the body healthy. You can imagine if somebody is just sitting in meditation for 12 hours a day, how unhealthy that lifestyle would be. So, and when you're unhealthy, then you become more vulnerable to illnesses. So if you keep the body healthy through asana practice, you'll be in better shape. But what about other illnesses that couldn't be treated in that way? It says in the next line, tap tap tapo mantra aushadhaihi kanschit kanschit upasargan kanschit upasargan vinirdahet. Some kinds of upasarga here means illness. Literally means any problem, but in this case, anything that comes in, the literal meaning here is what comes in the way of reaching your goal, what obstructs you from reaching your goal. So, kanschit upasargan, but some of these obstacles, which would be like more serious health issues, they should be nirdahet, vinirdahet, they should be removed. How? How? Through tapas, spiritual austerities, fasting, doing rituals, etc., mantra, chant more mantras and more rituals, and aushadha, herbs, herbal remedies. So in this way, all of those problems should be treated. All? Do you think all physical problems in ancient times could be treated by tapas or mantra or herbal remedies? If you have, what would be a good example? If you had diabetes in ancient times, and diabetes is a human problem, so what kind of tapas should you do to get out of this diabetes? Which mantras should you use? So apparently in the Atharva Veda, there's a certain mantra that you can chant if you get bitten by a poisonous snake. They actually give a mantra for that. Don't ask me if it works or not. I don't want to find out. but there is such a mantra. And of course, aushadha, you know, this Ayurveda has a long history. Are there mantras or Ayurvedic treatments which can cure everything? Certainly not. So now look at the difficulty. I'm sorry, I shouldn't use the word difficulty. Look at the problem here. We have a sincere yogi who is seeking what? So upasarga is an obstacle. And this is all about how to deal with these obstacles. Obstacles to what you're seeking. What is this yogi seeking? I called him a ku-yogi, a yogi who's been misdirected, better to call him a confused yogi. That would be a much better term. So this confused yogi is seeking what? An unconfused yogi will seek moksha, the highest goal of life. This confused yogi, as we said before, is seeking dhyana sukha, right? We discussed that before. They're seeking happiness and bliss through their practice of meditation. And the better they get at meditating, the more bliss they will experience. So the obstacles to the experience of dhyana sukha, the bliss of meditation, that's what they're getting rid of. So suppose they're relatively successful at removing these upasargas. In the best case, they are temporarily free from obstacles. Temporarily, right? There's no permanent solution. So temporarily free from all these problems. And then they practice, and what are they seeking? Dhyana sukha, which by nature comes and goes. It's also temporary. They have the temporary removal of obstacles and the temporary achievement of their goal. That doesn't sound like a big deal, does it? In fact, that kind of sounds like how most people live. Most people want to get whatever they want. You know, they have all these goals in life. There are obstacles to getting these goals. So they deal with the obstacle, upasarga. So they deal with the obstacles to reaching their goals. They get their goals, and then they discover after reaching the goal, they're still not happy. They're still unfulfilled. It's not enough. Whatever you can accomplish in worldly life, do you think one day you will have that magical attainment, attaining which all your problems would disappear? No one is so naive to believe that. And this is really the fundamental basis for the teachings of Vedanta, and that is no amount of worldly effort can ever bring about perfect peace, perfect contentment. It's just not possible. But this confused yogi, who was taught by an equally confused guru, is trying so hard. And in a best case scenario, they overcome most of their obstacles and they experience dhyana sukha every now, you know, to whatever extent they can, but it's not enough. Here Sri Krishna is talking about using spiritual practices to solve worldly problems, right? So, if, you know, the first one, in the first quarter of the verse was our poor yogi was too hot or too cold. So there are some practices to deal with that, being too hot or too cold. In the second line, if the knees are paining or whatever it is, there are other practices for that. And in the final half, there's other practices for dealing with illness. Is being too hot or cold or physical pain or illness, are these spiritual problems or worldly problems? When you solve a worldly problem, does it mean one problem is solved or all problems are solved? That's pretty obvious. And how many worldly problems are possible? Unending. You solve one problem after another. There's no end to solving problems that stand in the way of gaining perfect peace and contentment. We had this discussion several classes ago where we talked about all of this is like a doctor treating the symptoms and not treating the underlying cause. The symptoms of worldly life include being too hot, too cold, include pain, include illness, disease, and death. All of these are problems that get caught. They're lovely. I won't say lovely is a wrong expression. We're talking about illness. Can't talk about a lovely illness. We're talking about the illness of worldly life. Bhava roga. We used that term several weeks ago, maybe a month ago. Remember that? Bhava roga is a perspective in which we look upon worldly life as a kind of illness. And solving the illness of worldly life is now treating the cause and not symptoms. You get rid of cold or heat, and you get cold or hot again. Get rid of pain, if you have pain in one leg, you solve that problem, then what? Then you've got a pain in the other leg or in some other part of your body. This is how it goes. So instead of treating the symptoms, why not treat the cause? Well, this yogi unfortunately didn't have the proper teacher. Let's just briefly see this next verse and see. What is the alternative to solving all these individual worldly instead of solving individual worldly problems, why not solve the fundamental problem? The problem of bhavaroga, Sri Krishna says, kanchin mamanudhyanena, kanchin mamanudhyanena, nama sankirtanadibihi, nama sankirtanabihi. Yogeshwarana vrityava, Yogeshwaranu vrityava, Hanyadashubhan shanaihi, Hanyadashubhadan shanaihi. And I'm thinking about the fact that this is a wonderful verse, and we're at the end of a class. And instead of kind of pushing through this wonderful verse at the end of the class, let's wait till next week, and we'll see that. So where we're leaving this, we'll pick up the thread next time, is instead of seeking contentment in little drops, you solve one problem, you get a drop of contentment. You solve another problem, you get a drop of contentment. Why not find an ocean of contentment? And that's what Sri Krishna will discuss, will describe in the next verse. A couple of announcements. Tomorrow, Sunday, we have our Vedanta class, Shankara's text, at 10 a.m., followed by satsang at 11 a.m. And I'm very happy to announce that our Vasanti is resuming a program that she's done before. And it's a program of leading stotra chanting. And it's not just chanting. She also explains the meaning of everything. And then they actually meditate on some aspect of the stotra. So it includes these three things: chanting, explanation of meaning, and some meditation. I think she's taking a stotra addressed to Lord Rama. This program, because the program is meeting this coming Friday, and it will continue to meet on the second Friday of each month. It'll be at the homes of various students. It'll be conducted from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. Their flyers are posted. You can get more information. Or if you want to attend, you should let Pinky know. Pinky, would you stand up just to make sure everyone knows who you are? So you can contact Pinky, or you can find her email address also on this flyer. I'm really happy Vasanti is starting up this program. So it's just nice to get together in someone's home. And it says here, followed by prasad. that's good. We'll conclude with our prayers. Ganana Hantva Ganapati Gumavamahe Kavinga Vina Mupamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanas Patahana Shrinvan Uttabhisir Sadhanam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Guru Radmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyomavad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanuramardhanam Devaki Paramanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Guru Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhag Bhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor Ma Amritangamaya Om Shanti 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 Om Tat Sat.